Some of you took your whole break to study that passage, didn't you? Wow, I'm so impressed. Lou has volunteered. Lou, come on down. No, come on down here. Stand behind the mic. Teach us. Come on. Stand right there. Stand behind the podium. Put your notes there. Give us a, explain.
All right. We were always, or Pastor Nixon in our church would always preach about Corinth, how Corinth is sinful, how it's like a dock where all the it's like one way passageway going to a certain area, and all ships dock there. So all the sailors who's in the sea for like a couple of months would go there, and there's a lot of prostitutes here. So we were thinking, my group were thinking, that maybe the verse 3-5 would say that it refers to a different kind of warfare. For example, we read on the verse before this that Paul's letter was weighty, and you know, sometimes it's hard to do. So our second answer would be, for the Corinth, they would lead that there's a change in the way they think. And sometimes when we're in the church, we sometimes probably the church there would think that they won't let the prostitutes in or the gamblers in. So probably Paul would say, no, those were the people that you need to bring in.
Wow. So, you guys were working hard, weren't you? Explain that to me again. It refers to number one.
The way we handle, like for example, prostitution or handle perversion. It's not to say that the war is not waged in flesh, but you always have to bring it in the spirit. Like you pray for it, you bring encouragement.
All right, you may sit down. Okay, that was fascinating. I'm just totally fascinated by that. Jenny, come on down here. Come on, Jenny. Grab a mic as you walk by. Giselle, hand her a mic, would you?
As she comes, come down
and teach the class. Come right on down there. Teach the class.
Hello. Yes. Are you ready to learn?
Yeah. Come on, Jenny. Help us.
Until now, the three of us in our group are still figuring it out.
That's okay.
So we're not actually. We probably have three different versions of what I'm going to say. That was difficult. Okay. Well, we tried to look at the verses before it and
good.
After it.
Yeah.
And even
Lou, you didn't do that.
Yeah,
okay.
And even the book before it, which was 1 Corinthians, we had to understand where.
No wonder it took the whole break.
Yes, I know where he was
Why
coming
didn't you
from.
Why did you go back to Genesis?
I could, but you don't have time. So only the book before. Okay, so we were trying to understand why he wrote to the Corinthians in the first place in this book,
okay.
And why he said this. Okay, so in the first question, in one sentence, explain what verses 3-5 refer to, in my opinion.
Yes.
Okay, in a sentence, he probably is telling the Corinthians, after they attacked him in the painful letter, he felt attacked, probably. They probably criticized how he explained the gospel to them in the first book, and in the way he explained it to them, which probably made them feel like they were inferior, the way he said it in 1 Corinthians is like you're like infants. So they probably got insulted, I'm assuming. And so they said something to the effect that, you know, he's full of himself. You're full of words, like what Lou said, weighty words, but you're weak. You don't have substance and all that. So what he's probably trying to say here is that, you know, knowledge of God, it says up against the knowledge of God. Knowledge of God or preaching the gospel is like a war. It's like a battle where the weapons are not of the flesh, they're of the spirit. So that's probably what he was trying to say in verses 3 to 5. What did the passage mean to the first hearers, to those Corinthians? It probably changed their minds because they approached it like it was of the flesh.
Okay. Thank you, Jenny. No, you can take the mic with you. I don't need it.
So did you learn?
Wow. Whew. Was that hard to do?
Yeah, because we're still figuring it out.
When you normally hear this passage, what does it usually refer to? Spiritual warfare, right? Now, I'm surprised none of you brought that up. Why? Spiritual warfare, right? They use this. This is the verse quoted during the fast and when we're having prayer time. It's usually used in that context. But nobody made any mention of that. Pardon me?
I did.
I don't think you did. Well, you said something to do with prostitutes or something. Well, let me make some comments. First of all, good work. And I just threw you out there, okay? So this was a tough challenge. You don't have a lot of tools. So you worked hard at that was great. I don't think we got very close. although Jenny might have gotten closer than Lou. I'm not sure where Lou was. His team tried a little bit too hard. He had some basic facts about the historical context and tried to see it through that. I gave you the historical context information you needed. So you didn't need to go into that. I would have told you that if you needed. I gave you what you needed right there in that paragraph. Nobody told me about what they saw, or little, you did a little bit, about the verses that came before it, and especially the verses that go after it. This verse is normally referred to as fighting demonic forces. And this is what we do when we're praying and we're breaking spiritual forces over cities and countries and nations. Now, first of all, it has absolutely nothing to do with that. Can we just say that at the outset? So how it's normally used is generally incorrect. That's not what it refers to in context. But what it does refer to, which you'll find if you just read a little bit farther, is this is Paul having apostolic warfare with this church over the truth. So he's presenting the truth. They fought him. And some people have repented and respond to the truth, and there's still some that who are fighting. And so his point is there is warfare, but it's the warfare against the people who are resisting the gospel truth that he's presenting. So can we use this passage in a prayer meeting? Well, what you have to do in Bible interpretation is you look at original intent. What did the author mean when he wrote it to his audience? And that's what we get first. Then we look at what were the principles behind what he said to that group. And do those principles apply in other situations? It's not specifically a prayer passage. It's not a verse about taking authority about demonic forces, but it does refer to the spiritual warfare that we wage in this world against truth and people who resist the truth. So there is some application. So if your pastor quotes this in a prayer meeting, don't go up to him and tell him, Paul says, you're wrong. There is some application, but the main issue that's being dealt with here is when we live in this world, there are people who will fight against the gospel truth. And our war with them is not fleshly warfare. So we don't attack them in the way that worldly people do. We understand that behind that there's all sorts of other spiritual issues that we deal with. And so we're fighting the warfare spiritually with God's truth and continuing to proclaim His truth, and His truth ultimately breaks through. Again, you can see, you can take that principle. And that does apply because demonic forces try to resist the truth from being presented to people. So we can use that verse, although it's not primarily intended to mean that. And a really careful reading of the context, I mean, even verse 6, Paul says, we are prepared to punish all disobedience when your obedience is complete. Obviously, he's not referring to demonic forces there. So just by a careful reading of the context, we get a lot more insight. That was a tough one. The next one I give you will be harder. No. You're ready for the challenge. And sometimes just the process of wrestling with the scripture is valuable in itself. Just thinking, wrestling. Because then you know what it produces? Questions. Like most of you at the end of the exercise probably had more questions about that passage than you did before. More questions than you had answers. That's great. That's what Bible study should produce. Questions. Because here's how God instructs us. First, He gives us the question. Then He gives us the answer. See, people have probably given you the answer before in sermons you've heard, but because you don't have the question, you don't even hear it. But when you've had a question in your mind, sometimes it'll just be not even really a major point that the preacher made, maybe even a secondary comment, but it answers the question that you've had in your mind for a long time. Now, a lot of the other people in the audience, they didn't get the same thing. They didn't have the question. You see, God gives questions first. I'm really wanting to figure that out. I don't know. And you're listening, then you hear it. You get the answer because you got the question. So don't be distraught if Bible study just produces more questions. That's part of the process. Now you're going to be a lot more attuned and listening for answers. Until you get the questions, you won't even hear the answers. Okay, third thing to look for is words. What do I mean by words? Well, look for key words that are repeated in the passage. Key words. For example, in Mark's gospel, there's a word that's repeated 40 times in the first few chapters. Kenneth? Excellent. Yeah, it's immediately. Immediately. 40 times he uses the word immediately. Now, when you see a word like that being repeated, it must mean something. What do we understand from that? Well, the main thing we understand is, I told you earlier, who was Mark getting his gospel information from? Peter. What do we know about Peter? Huh, Joanne? What do we know about Peter? Very what? Aggressive, impulsive, right? Yeah. Activator, yeah. He's the guy that chops off Malchus's ear, remember? When they come to take Jesus away, he's the guy that the only time he ever opens his mouth is to change feet. He's always putting his foot in his mouth, and heaven forbid, Lord, and Jesus has to say, I rebuke you, Satan. He's the impulsive one, you see? And so we get this idea immediately. Peter is the action guy, and so Mark's the action gospel. One thing we find in Mark's gospel is Mark continually tells us that Jesus taught, but then never tells us what Jesus taught. You can tell, because here's Peter. Peter's like, come on, get the sermon over. Because what does Peter want? He wants the miracles after the preaching. He wants to lay hands on people. He wants dead people being raised and blind eyes open. And so we get almost no teaching in Mark. Although we're continually told, and Jesus taught. Peter wasn't paying much attention. He just wanted, but you get lots of description about the miracles, because that's what Peter wanted. Miracles, action, just goes from one scene to another. There's constant action taking place. We see that in the word immediately. When we read the book of Romans, this word righteousness keeps showing up. What does it mean? Well, remember, our basic principle, Lou, answer this question. Who wrote the Bible?
God and man.
God and man, right? Now, as charismatics, we only think about the God side. So when we see the word righteousness used in one place by one author, we assume it has a uniform meaning all throughout Scripture. But it doesn't. Which is what you would expect, Ethel, if you had a bunch of different people writing. We all use words differently. And they have different meanings. So when Paul uses the word righteousness, it's different than when James uses the word righteousness. And so if you just read James, righteousness, well, I know how Paul uses it, so it must mean the same thing. There's nuances, see? Because every word has meaning in context, right? Some words in some meanings have almost opposite context. Some words in different contexts have almost opposite meanings. It takes the context to explain the word. Now let's see this word righteousness in Romans. What does that mean? You got to look for it and try to understand what is the word righteousness. Because if you don't understand Paul's use of the word righteousness, you're going to have a hard time understanding anything in Romans. So look for words that are repeated. Look for words that define the relationship between things. Words that define relationships. Okay, so for example, beta. Is that right? Beta? Beta. These words, however, nevertheless, yet, what do they imply? However, nevertheless, yet. What does that imply? Just talk. He'll turn it on when he'll talk when he hears it. Go ahead. You just talk into the microphone, and the man back there will turn it up. As go ahead.
I think, however, yet there's something that will happen. Or
No, I heard it over here. Who said it?
Contradiction.
Not quite contradiction. What? Real loud. Yeah, we're not quite getting the word yet. Contrast. However, is contrast, right? What's come we've said and said, however, we're contrasting what's going to follow with what's already been said. One thing, nevertheless, say one thing, yet, there's a contrast. So oftentimes we pass over those words, seem to be, those are secondary words, but they give us meaning. They imply relationship. Whatever's been said connects to what's going to be said. Romans chapter 12, therefore I urge you, present your body as living and holy. What does the therefore refer to? What's the contrast? What's the connection? See? How about, let's go with Rich. Rich, the word if or however, what relationship does that imply? Rich, help her out there. Move those mics as fast as we can. If.
If it means in context, conditional.
Yeah, it's conditional. Exactly right. Conditional. So if my people, which are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray, then I will hear from heaven and heal their land. So the if, automatically we know there's a condition involved here. There's a promise, but the promise is conditional. How about Mimi? How you doing over there, Mimi? Mimi, if you hear these words, also, likewise, in the same way, what relationship is implied there?
I think considering hearing the first idea, you have to consider another idea to follow.
Yeah. So give me one word that sums up the relationship. Also, likewise, in the same way.
The relation.
Who knows the word? Yell it out.
Additional.
No, Rich? Additional. Comparison. That's the word. It's a comparison. Yeah. Also. So we've talked about one thing. Also. This is compares with that. Likewise. Those two compare together. It's not a contrast. It's a comparison. There's similarities, right? Contrast means different. Comparison means similarity. Okay, Ramir, how about this? Try these words. Therefore, thus, so then. Yeah?
Summary.
No? No? Thus, so then, therefore. Who's got it? Rich? No? This is cause and effect. Cause and effect. So you see, therefore, they're about to tell you what? The effect. Because what's already come is the cause. Therefore, cause and effect. How about these words? Let's go with Zane. Zane, now. Immediately, when, before, after, during. What kind of relationship does that imply? What kind of relationship?
Like,
huh? I can't hear you real loud. Now, immediately, when, before, after, during.
It's like we have to do it.
What?
Now. Take action or something.
No, no. What's the relationship? Yeah. Temporal. It's a time relationships. Now as opposed to not some other time. Immediately. When. Before. After. You see, that's all time. How about these? Let's try like a. Where or from. What kind of relationships implied there? Where and from? Huh? Yeah, okay. We say geographical. Geographical. Yeah, geographical. Okay. So look for these little words, because they give you a lot of insight into what's happening. Okay, number four. Whew. How's everybody doing? What? Are you full?
Nosebleed.
Nosebleed? Overwhelmed? Oh, this is just the introductory material. This is the dumbed down version from the dumbed down version from the real material. Ah, that's funny. Okay, well, let's make it a little harder. The fourth thing to look for is principles. Principles. What's a principle? I'm so glad you asked me that question. A principle is a timeless truth that transcends the particulars of a specific situation. It's a timeless truth that transcends the particulars of a specific situation. So, for example, in our class yesterday with the pastors, we were examining 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and Paul has a lengthy passage about women praying and prophesying with their head covered, having a head covering. Okay? Now, I was raised Roman Catholic, and years ago, this was pre-Vatican II, women all had to have their heads covered in church. Is that the case in the Philippines, or was it ever for... Yeah. It was, in the Roman Catholic churches?
And they're reviving it.
Yeah, reviving it, huh? Yeah. Well, there's that scriptural evidence in Corinth. Paul was talking about and making sure that the women, when they prayed or prophesied in church, had their head covered. Now, I have a friend who has churches in the U.S. and also in England. He's a good friend of mine. I speak for him often when I'm in the States. And they practice that. So it's a prophesying church, right? They had their annual convention this summer, and I spoke for them. And there's a lot of prophesying going on, more prophesying than preaching. And whenever the women would pray or prophesy, they would cover their head. Now, sometimes they'd have a nice scarf or something that they might, or a ball cap, or, you know, the shawl or something. They'd cover their heads when they pray and prophesy based on that passage. And so we were looking at that passage and examining it. Now, we have a lot of situations like that in the New Testament, especially where we have issues that were culturally related that no longer have any meaning to us because of our culture. It's different. So we don't practice head covering at Victory, and we shouldn't. It's not meant to be a normative practice for churches all over. But what we do and what we looked at is we examine what are the principles. We don't do the practice. But what were the principles behind the practice? Even though we don't use the practice, there's still a lot that we can learn that can be helpful when we look at what are the principles underlying that practice, you see? What are the timeless truths that transcend the specifics of the historical situation? We're looking for principles. So Paul talked about not eating or eating meat sacrificed to idols. Okay, well, not a big deal really for the most part, most people today. But what's the principles behind it? And although the issue is not a big problem, the principles behind the issue are a huge problem and concern for us in 21st century Manila in our Victory churches. So you're trying to go beyond and just looking at the custom and wondering, that's kind of weird. I'm glad we don't do that now. Or maybe, ladies, you like hats and you wish we did that, you know, or something. But you look, what's the principles behind it? Pull those out and then apply those in a multiplicity of different ways. So we're looking for principles. Is that okay? Questions? Anybody want to bring back head coverings? No. Okay. Last thought here. And we're not going to be able to get to parables, unfortunately, but there's next year. Here's just a list of questions to ask when you read the Bible. Because effective Bible reading involves bombarding the text with questions. Any of you who are married, have children, if you got little ones, you know that when they hit that stage, they start asking the why questions, right? There's just a million questions. Why? You have to act like that when you read the Bible. Act like a three-year-old. Why? Who, how, what, when, where? Ask all those questions. So your questions like, who's writing? Who's he writing it to and why? What's the author's subject? What's the life situation of the author? What's the life situation of the hearers? What important words are repeated and what do they mean? What literary form is the author using and why? What's the emotional state of the author and how does it affect his writing? What's the point of the verse, paragraph, chapter, or book? What did the passage mean to the first hearers? When does the action take place and why is that significant? Where does the author write from and how did that affect his writing? Where do the hearers live and how do their circumstances affect the writing? Why is the author writing to these particular hearers? How does the author present his subject? How does the author introduce his subject? How does the grammatical structure of the verse, passage, or book affect the meaning? How does the author's culture and historical setting affect his writing? All these questions. Now, fortunately, there's so many helps for us nowadays. Any good study Bible will, before you start a particular book, like before 1 Corinthians, they'll give you background information. And you can actually just do a little search on the internet, go to whatever browser you use, and historical background to the letter to the Ephesians. And watch, you'll get all kinds of sources. And you get a lot of good background information that answers a lot of these questions and will help the text come alive to you. So you're asking questions all the time. You're not a passive reader, you're an active reader, bombarding the text. Why? All right? Is that enough? Is that enough for one day? Can't handle any more? Tristan wants more. You've already heard this, though, Tristan, right? You attended, my seminar, so. All right, God bless you. We'll go home a little early. And this is it for this semester, right? So, Karen, do you know when our next class is? Jack? We're counting on you, Jack. Don't let us down. God bless you. Thank you. I didn't think you could applaud because your noses were bleeding so bad.